This podcast is rated S for science and also for spoilers and swearing. There's going to be swearing.
Something is killing these people and sucking them dry.
Run! It's a stampede!
Welcome everyone to Cinematica Animalia, the podcast where we advocate against the mating of fishmen and humans. We also like to look at everyone's favorite monster, scaly fish being that people want to try to sleep with, but they shouldn't be doing it, and try to break it down and look at the science behind it. My name is Adam. I am today's main host, not the co-host today. I'm back from my first part of my candidacy. Thank you all for your well wishes during that stressful and horrible time. Now the real fun part gets to come up for me in about a week, but that's neither here nor there. Today we're going to be looking at the horrible science and ecology related tropes and physiological related tropes in movies. Before that, let me introduce co-host number 47, David. Unfortunately, our other host, Sam, is not going to be here today. He is off fomenting rebellion in Greece, leading an uprising against the fascists. So, Dave, how's it going?
Now, when you say that Sam is bringing uprising, I mean, we should let people know that it's literally Sam just standing in the square with a poorly written sign, yelling things incoherently at various strangers that are passing by. Like, it's not a successful campaign.
I mean, I've been to a couple countries with Sam in Europe, and that's about what he would do every single time, so it checks out. People might not know this, but Sam is actually 3 meters tall, so every time he stands up, he is rising up, quite literally.
Any news or updates in terms of, you said the candidacy exam went well?
Yeah, the written part went well. I've got the oral here in about a week, at least a week from when we're recording this, so that's super fun. It is now finally spring here in the southern United States, and for me, as an aquatic ecologist that uses insects in all my research, that means that the field season is kicking off with a bang. I've been in the field almost every single day the last 2 weeks, picking bugs, setting up experiments, building cages. I'll be building more cages later today, slicing up my hands with chicken wire, so that's super fun. How are things up there in the land of maple syrup, beavers, and moose?
Good. In terms of things are busy, we are entering into the spring season, so we're starting to see an uptick in our number of sort of emergency cases related to the great outdoors. But yeah, no, things have been busy. I have just started a new position at another hospital, and it is busy.
Did they find out you're not actually a vet? So,
not yet. No, I mean, the nice thing with veterinary medicine is since you're not a real doctor, nobody really checks your references or degrees.
Perfect. Just the way you like it.
Yeah, super nice. It's super nice. Yeah, you just hand over something written in crayon and you're good to go.
Yeah, excellent. So I think if Sam had any news, it would just be about how the rebellion's going. So we can only hope it's going well. Mm-hmm. Haven't seen any smoke signals or gotten any ravens from him recently. So let's hope for the best.
Let's imagine for a few moments what our life would be like if we could access, let's say, 20% of our brain's capacity.
Today's topic, like I was saying earlier, is the common science movie tropes. The other week, not the supplemental, touched on some of the best and at least the worst movie scientists for sure. And now we're kind of staying kind of in that same general theme of fun or bad science things in movies. We'll be getting back to the monsters before too long with a return to the Game of Thrones dragons, I believe, next week. But we're going to be touching on some common ecological and physiological tropes in movies relating to science. And Dave, since you usually kick us off with physiology, how about you kick us off with your first trope?
The one that I wanted to start us off with today is the you only use 10% of your brain.
Which has been so made it bad in the last 5-10 years with movies like Lucy and Limitless.
Lucy was going to be the biggest example. So we don't really know where this myth started. As far as we can tell, there appeared to be some form of ad that popped up in the 1929 World Almanac that did claim that scientists would tell us that we only use a total of 10% of our brain power, and it seemed to just kind of go from there. So your brain, as we've discussed before in this show, is incredibly energy dependent. It does use about 20% of all of the energy in your body to run it.
Yep.
Although different areas might light up at different times, it's not like we're only utilizing 10%. We do strategically use different areas of the brain for different points. I mean, that's why we have things like the visual cortex, or that is the point of sort of the frontal lobe, in terms of we are utilizing multiple aspects, and we may be using aspects more depending on what time it is. But the main points against this whole theory are, one, we have no idea how much of the brain that you're using at one time. Just because MRIs and other scans have shown that the entire brain is active at different points. Two, we know that there's no area of your brain that isn't necessary, because any brain damage that occurs in any area of the brain leads to some form of impairment. We know that there really are no specific areas of the brain that stay dark or normally work at an area where they have very low energy.
Yep.
And we know that, you know, there would be no point, natural selection, more sort of in your guys' field of ecology and that kind of thing, you wouldn't keep selecting for a piece of tissue that's using up larger quantities of energy if you could reduce in size or move in a direction that would allow you theoretically to waste less.
Yeah, exactly. That's kind of, I think, the first thought that might come to people's mind with that is like vestigial organs, something like your appendix, your tonsils, or what other, you know, stuff in your body that's kind of still there. We don't use it anymore. But also, those structures are not using nearly as much energy as your brain does. If there was something in your body, like your brain, that was not being used at all, or even that much, but it was costing you that much energy, it would, evolutionarily speaking, very quickly be removed from your physiology.
Now, as a cool side note, something that people who are writing these types of science things might be more interested in, there does appear to be a limit on the brain that can be placed in sort of the energy demands at one time. There is a really interesting group of neuroscientists out of a sector of the University of Toronto and one of the groups associated with the Toronto Hospital that have been doing some cool work for the last couple of years and on people using cell phones while they're driving. And what they've been finding is that a certain area of your brain lights up when you're on the cell phone and you're talking with someone because you're visualizing what they're telling you. So if you're on the phone with your partner and they're discussing, you know, where they are, what's going on at work, you are to a certain degree picturing where they are. And if you're on that cell phone and then you're also driving and you're trying to take in a lot of visual data associated with people around you and cars driving and things like that while you're doing something complicated like making a left-hand turn into sort of two or three lanes of traffic to try and cross, there actually is some research to suggest that you might actually override the visual cortex and put yourself in a position where you, when people say like, oh my God, I hit Adam on the side of the road, I just didn't see him. There actually is some new research to suggest you might actually not see Adam. That if you've got all this other stimuli going on and this other information that's occupying the brain, you might not be able to effectively process all the information around you, and you might actually miss something. But for summary, you use your entire brain, you're not using 10%. You can't take a special pill and become Lucy and speak 1,000 languages. This really isn't a thing.
So turn that's something into a that gets fucking used. Hard drive.
This is something that gets used way too often. Please stop using it. You will make your films a lot better if you just cut out this thing that, honestly, I couldn't finish Lucy because the premise was just too stupid.
Perfect organism. Its structural perfection is matched only by its hostility.
You admire it.
I admire its purity.
So, Adam, moving back to the ecology side, is there one that you'd like to start with from your ecology list?
Yeah, I think where we want to start kind of is the perfect predator or the perfect organism. Mm-hmm. You have this in a variety of movies. I think the one I'm going to kind of pick, because they literally say it in the movie, is the xenomorph, where in the first Alien, 1979, I believe, you have the android, Ash, when he goes crazy and tries to kill everyone. His mission from the company is to bring this xenomorph back for research as a biological weapon and to use it, and his specific directive is that the crew are expendable, which in this case they're very much expendable because you need at least one member of this crew to complete this alien's life cycle. But he uses the words that, like, they have no hope, they have no chance against this, it is perfectly evolved, perfectly adapted, this perfect being, which in nature does not exist. The fun thing about evolution and natural selection is that over a long, long, long period of time, you have selection. If selection stays the same, it does change over time, and it can also change very rapidly. But if it stays more or less the same, you have organisms and populations, not a single organism. Selection acts on a population, or evolution happens within a population. Selection acts on an organism. But over time, you'll have these organisms become better and better suited to the environment they're in, because the ones that aren't suited die off. They are killed, they don't survive, they're killed, they can't get food as well, they're outcompeted, whatever. Only the ones that are well-suited to that environment, to those specific conditions, make it. So in that sense, you have some organisms that are, quote-unquote, perfectly adapted. But you cannot have an organism that is the best, the absolute best at every single thing it ever does. In nature, you have trade-offs. I'm going to be pulling from Jurassic Park a lot in this episode just because it's the one that's been, I cannot get these images out of my head. The Indominus Rex is an example where it is incredibly large, incredibly fast, incredibly smart. I'll be touching more on that later. They can talk to the other dinosaurs. It can be a literal chameleon and make itself invisible. It's just, this doesn't exist. If you're that big, you cannot be that fast. If you're that smart, it's going to come at some other cost with your metabolic function, possibly, because
you're going to lose a lot of energy.
So much energy.
Yeah. And, I mean, do you want to explain the Alice in Wonderland, the treadmill idea that's seen in ecology?
Yeah, that's the that's called the Red Queen hypothesis. Mm-hmm. So the way that works is that you're, for those who are not familiar with Alice in Wonderland, the Red Queen kind of keeps Alice going constantly. There's the goalposts are always moving, basically. And in ecology, at least in evolution, you have a lot of populations that kind of have this dynamic. It's also called negative frequency dependent selection, where you have a population of a given species, and you have maybe one or a couple of different like types of an organism. And at one time, the rare morph, the rare type, will have an advantage for whatever reason. Maybe most of these butterflies are blue, some of them are red. Because most of them are blue, the predators are usually going to associate blue, like if a bird is looking at these butterflies, the bird is going to associate that blue color with prey. So the blue ones are going to be eaten far more than the red ones are. So the red ones have an advantage. Over time, the blue ones will diminish in population size, and the red ones will become the majority of that population. Then it switches. Now the predator is focusing on the red butterflies, the blue ones have the advantage. And this cycling, this negative frequency dependent selection, this Red Queen dynamic goes on over and over and over. And you have that in a lot of populations.
Yeah, no, you can never win in evolution.
It's never static.
No, you were always competing. You're never at a point where you're just like, hey, I've become the top predator. I don't have to evolve or change or improve anymore because everything else is evolving and changing. You're all racing. Nobody wins. They just keep running.
Exactly. And there's some people in my department who would have a very strong opinion on this, but evolution is not goal-oriented. There is no objective.
No.
There is no end point to it. You're just doing the best that you can, when you can, and the ones that are able to do the best survive. It's literally survival of the fittest, and it's called that for a reason. One thing, fun fact, speaking of evolution and survival of the fittest, in the biological literature, the evolutionary literature, this type of organism is called a Darwinian demon, the one that is the absolute best at every single thing it does, and it cannot be outcompeted. And if that was true, it would be the only organism on the planet because nothing could beat it. But obviously, there's more than one organism on this planet.
And whenever you hear something like, oh, the great white shark, I mean, it's such a perfect predator, it's never had to evolve. That's not true. It's still undergoing evolutionary changes. Nothing is static. It might not change as much as other organisms around it because it might have found a good niche to occupy, but there are still alterations going on.
Exactly. It's it and crocodilians as well are good examples of something that has its niche, the place it lives in the world, its environment, its the things it eats, the things it has to compete with, have stayed more or less the same since the last couple hundred million years. And it's a similar thing for the insects that I work with, dragonflies. Some of them are very, very, very old as a species, and they have not changed that much. They have changed. That's not to say that they are the exact same as they were back then, because if they were, you'd have a dragonfly that was 3 feet long. They don't exist anymore because the environment has changed so much that they can no longer be that big. Same for all arthropods or insects, that kind of organism. But for the sharks, they are more or less the same. They have changed a bit.
And he goes, I'm sorry about that, Che. I really screwed the pooch on that one. And I said, what was that? And he goes, screw the pooch. It means I made a mistake. And I was like, no, man, it means you fucked the dog.
So now getting back to the physiology, what you got for us next, Dave?
I wanted to briefly touch on the idea of the interspecies romances and interspecies diseases. One, because this comes up all the time in science fiction. But two, because it comes up a lot in my profession on a pretty regular basis.
People loving their animals too much?
People asking me all the time, they're like, oh, well, you know, like, I've got a cold. Am I worried about my cat? Or, you know, you just told me, so feline herpes is very present within cats. It's something like 96% of the population has it. It's fine. It's okay. But I've had owners react with disgust and, like, even push their cat away in the exam room when I'm like, yeah, I think your cat has herpes. It's fine. It's not transmissible. But the minute you drop a word like that, you have a large group of people that are like, oh, my God, I don't want to get herpes from my cat. So we do see this a lot. One of the biggest offenders being the Star Trek series, despite their attempts in various episodes to come up with excuses about why certain species are able to interbreed. But generally speaking, even on Earth, you can't interbreed. Like, the species differentiate and separate, and once they become separated, there are examples of certain species that can cross, and there are actually different forms of infertility. So the first thing is, very few species can copulate. All right, there are infertilities associated with the fact of you just simply can't mate. The uterus, the penis, the whatever your copulation organs are not designed in such a way that they're compatible. We see a lot of variation in organs on the planet that are completely different. If you are able to get the organs together, you can have an offspring that is produced that is simply incompatible with life, that will not survive, and simply dies either during the gestation period or shortly after birth.
Or it won't even be able to gestate. You might not even have the sperm able to fertilize the egg.
Yeah. And then the last form in these situations where people bring up, and the biggest ones I see are mules and ligers, where people are like, oh, well, that's a good example of the species. Yeah. They're born infertile. So this is hybrid infertility. These are species that are born, yes, are able to grow up, although oftentimes do have a number of different defects associated with them. But find themselves in a situation where they can't mate. They don't have the ability, that the genetics that have been involved in generating them are completely incompatible with continuing any form of life going forward. So this idea that we see these alien species from drastically different solar systems that get together and somehow manage to mate quite easily and generate children are always one of these situations of like, no, I'm sorry, this
it's
just
not gonna happen.
It doesn't. It's not. I mean, if species on the same planet most of the time can't interbreed, you can't fuck an alien. I'm really sorry.
Nope. You could fuck it, but nothing's going to happen from it.
Fair enough. Although, I mean, I don't imagine the act of that would be all that pleasant.
Imagine the alien.
I don't know, Adam, if you're a big fan of South Park, but they have a fantastic episode about the Gelgamesh, which are an alien species that arrives, and they're attempting to have the discussion that more Gelgamesh aliens need to be having sex with Gelgamesh females. And one of the aliens gets really upset and describes the Gelgamesh vagina as 10 feet tall and filled with razor-sharp teeth. So, and then the other note just on the interspecies is the diseases. And the biggest offender here being the War of the Worlds. And the idea that we see in the War of the Worlds that goes on, they have the discussion of this alien species arrives and they end up getting destroyed by the bacteria and viruses that, you know, live on Earth, with Morgan Freeman's great voice again in the background. It's a great idea. George Orwell had some, like, I mean, Orson Welles had some interesting ideas on this idea, and it was a cool idea for way back then. But the thing is, diseases and viruses are incredibly specific. This again feeds into the idea of you're not going to get herpes from your cat. These types of things do not easily move from one animal to another, which is why when we discuss, you know, major epidemics or pandemics, they don't tend to cross from one group to the other. And they don't tend to effectively kill off, like when we're discussing the worst pandemic that could hit Earth, like one that would hit the human species and wipe out, you know, the greatest number of humans, we're talking about a kill rate somewhere between 15 and 30%. 30% being the absolute utmost limit. We are not talking about a virus that wipes out every single animal or every single human on the planet, because there's just too much variation. Adam and I's immune systems are very different. How we're going to react to a different virus or bacteria, I could get completely wiped out, and Adam could get a bad cold for a couple weeks.
Yeah, but also touching on that, it could be something even as similar as what we just talked about with feline herpes or feline AIDS. Just because one species can get it or has some what we call herpes doesn't mean it's the same thing as when we get herpes. Yep. And it's not going to be able to cross species. But touching on that, an interesting thing with whenever you have invasive species and disease or parasites, there's a couple different things that can happen if these parasites are able to jump species. You could have a, usually they call it, it's called the enemy release hypothesis, where you have an invasive species come somewhere new, maybe an alien coming to our planet or the Spanish conquistadors coming to North America, and they now the diseases they are used to from their own home are not present in this new environment. So now they are free to they're released from this pressure, this either a, also predators apply to this, but especially with humans, they no longer have these diseases. There might be new diseases there, and that is another dynamic where you can have this spill over, where you have these native diseases or parasites then affect the invasive species. And I think that's the, called the novel weapon hypothesis, where you have, yeah, you have these, cool. The native species have some kind of parasite, some kind of disease, and it just destroys whatever invasive species comes in. Or you can have spillover and spill back. So spillover is where you have these invasive species bring parasites with them, like you had in the conquistadors and the all the native peoples of Central and North America, where they bring these diseases, they bring, I think the natives had syphilis, but the disease, the Europeans brought smallpox, and it just wipes out everyone because they have zero immunity to it, they have zero experience with it, but because they are closely related, it can jump to this new population and just destroy them. And then you also have spill back, where you have a population, maybe like once again like the Spanish, they come over, they have some kind of disease. Now the disease jumps to the natives. The natives now have it. This disease builds up and proliferates, and now there's even more of it than there would have been back at home because this new population is so vulnerable to it. They all get it, and now all the Spaniards are vulnerable as opposed to some of them when they go back home.
Right. And again, just to emphasize, as Adam is saying, when he says, you know, everybody gets it and everybody gets decimated, we're not talking about kill rates close to, you know, 70, 80%. We're just talking about high sickness rates and a kill rate above what's normally seen. So again, getting a kill rate up exactly to 30 or 40% is still incredibly decimating to whatever group is affected, but it's still not going to completely wipe out a group. Like the end of War of the Worlds where every single alien dies. No.
Not so much.
Sorry, Tom Cruise, but you're still dead.
You're still a crazy Scientologist.
We won't get into that.
They're too intelligent. Even now, the Raptors are probably evolving and figuring out a way to outsmart us. Nature finds a way.
Hey, guys, can you let me in? I really want to kill everyone in that room.
See? They've already learned to speak just by watching us.
So for the ecology, these are kind of two topics that kind of go hand in hand. One of them being intelligence in monsters or animals, other one being personality. So a big thing, especially with monsters in movies, is how smart these organisms are. And that usually plays into some kind of reveal later in the movie, like it's learning or it remembers. Once again, with the Indominus Rex in Jurassic World, you have these scientists go into the cage where this gigantic dinosaur is. Why would you ever go in there, you stupid, stupid right? people? But they find this tracker, and it's been removed from this from the dinosaur's body. And they're like, well, how could it do this? How would it know? It's like, oh, well, it remembers. There is absolutely no fucking way a dinosaur would remember, any animal, even a human, would remember some kind of radio tracker put into their body when they were an infant, when they had just been born. It's just not how your brain works. It's not how any animal's brain works. Even if you have an eidetic memory, your brain is not formed at that point enough to kind of form any kind of concrete long-term memories. And for that, an animal to be able to do that is absolutely nonsense.
Yeah, or, Sam's girlfriend stuck a tracker into him months ago and he still hasn't found it.
Okay, Sam, don't listen to that.
Right, yeah, sorry, never mind.
Yeah, just forget you heard anything, it's all good. But yeah, going with the remembering, but also the learning. For the original Jurassic Park, you have these velociraptors. They're not really velociraptors. That's not how big a velociraptor is. A velociraptor is the size of a turkey. Ugh, that's a whole other thing that I'm mad about. But they get in and they're able to open the doors with very little problem. And I know people think that the raptors were very intelligent for dinosaurs. They think that they were pack hunters. They had a relatively large brain case. So in all likelihood, they were very smart animals. But for these things to just be able to go in without any kind of training, any kind of watching of the humans, just go in to be able to open doors, no problem, it's too much. It's not how it works. Do you have any other examples of that, Dave?
I think that you're hitting it on the head of just they can't be this. And again, I mean, there's a common discussion that goes on when it comes to animals of the idea that if Adam and I could actually speak lion and we could speak to a lion, we still wouldn't be able to speak to a lion because our context, our points of reference are completely different. We struggle enough with having discussions with humans from other cultures.
Yeah.
The idea that other species would be able to simply step in and understand, oh, doorknob. Doorknob is like, it gets opened like this. No, like a doorknob is a complex learned behavior. Something that you have to see if like, oh, it's gripped and it's turned or manipulated in such a way. Or the concept of a door in of itself, right? Like, oh, this opens or this closes in a certain direction, force has to be applied. We do see our pets start to pick these up. But I mean, that's after extensive period of time before your cat finally starts figuring out like, oh, I can start doing this. Knowledge and intelligence, as we've discussed before, are not the same thing. You can be super duper intelligent, but walking into the world and having knowledge, having experience, understanding, this is the way that this has to work. And we are littered with examples of aliens and creatures. It's not even being too intelligent for their own good. It's somehow encountering knowledge and context that they wouldn't be able to gain.
Yeah, exactly. Or any kind of cultural relevance. A large part of touching on likely what you're saying with language, but also the way we do everything is built on our specific culture, either as specific cultures within humans or just human culture in general. Going back to the door example, it'd be really weird. I mean, a door is you would think it's a universal thing, but who knows what other kind of species, other kind of aliens would use as a door and what they would view. It also would depend on their body plan, how they can move, what they view as, I mean, if they're even bounded by the same laws of physics as we are. It all depends on that your subjective reality, your subjective physiology, all of that. And for an animal like the velociraptor to just be able to walk up to what to them should look like another part of the wall and be like, this is obviously the door. A door will get me into this place. This is the handle for the door. I need to turn this handle to be able to get in. It's too many leaps to be able to get there.
No, done way too quickly in terms of without any trial and error, just straight to that idea. And that's also, Adam brings up a good point in regards to body plan. We build doors, we build cars, we build these sorts of things because of the way that we're built. Another species walking in, it's not going to be a super straightforward leap because, like, I mean, a dog manipulates everything with its face. The way
most
that
animals
they
without
build...
hands use their mouth for any kind of touch. It's like a shark attack. Whenever you have somebody having like a big chunk taken out of them, but they weren't killed, is because the shark thought they were food, they took a chunk out of them, realized they weren't food, and they left them alone. Sure, that sucks for you, but that was just a shark's way of finding out what you are because they can't touch you with their hands because they don't have hands.
Yeah. Somebody drew up a mock-up of what a dog car would look like a couple of years ago as a joke, and how you would design it, how a dog would think to try and design it, and again, this is kind of their joking way, but they would have to build it in such a way that they thought mouth manipulation would be the easiest, simplest way. Like, we don't know how they build their seats or what would be most comfortable for them or how they would go about this because it would just be so alien to our way of thinking.
This makes me think of about body plans. Back in the day, at least in the U.S., we had Starburst, or Laffy Taffy used to have little, like, jokes or thought experiments on their wrappers. And the one that will always, always stick with me was, what would chairs look like if our knees went the other way? And I cannot imagine in my head what that would look like to this day. And that was 20-something years ago. Because you would think, oh, you just reverse the chair. But then your chest is leaning on the back of it. That's uncomfortable. Your genitalia would be resting on it, especially for a guy. That's not very comfortable. That's not going to work. And it's just that one simple little switch, your knees bending the way they go to the opposite way, is going to switch up so many things about your life. Now imagine trying to come at that from the cultural viewpoint of having zero experience. But even if you get it right, you're not going to get the fine tuning of it right, which is something you see in language all the time. A good example of this with behavior, I saw this thing on Reddit yesterday of this dog in this town has been seeing people like go into this shop and pay for ice cream, you know, with paper bills. And so now every day it gets a leaf, it goes into the shop and it gives the workers a leaf. So like your behavior is kind of right, but you're completely getting the subtlety of it wrong.
You're missing the nuance, and again, you're just repeating a behavior as close as you possibly can.
Exactly.
And that's a very intelligent dog that's doing that, so no.
A very intelligent dog.
Exactly. You're missing out on a big chunk. So no, not a system. And again, an easy tweak that could be made in common science fiction to make our films more interesting. If the raptor was scraping away at the door or testing things for a little while, it'd be far more believable.
Exactly. And then touching on very quickly the segue there from behavior to segue, nice little segue into personality. In a lot of movies, you see a lot of animals, a lot of monsters, whatever, that have a distinct personality. They behave in a certain way. They interact with the humans in a very specific way, in a way that we would very much project our own thoughts, our own feelings onto these creatures. It's not how it works. That's called anthropogenizing, where you are projecting human thoughts and human psychology onto these animals. It doesn't work like that. You have in the field of ecology, or at least in research, there are a lot of people that subscribe to the idea of animal personality, which I'm just going to go ahead and say, I think it's nonsense. As smart as some organisms are, they might have a bit of personality in a sense that they behave in a certain way, but it's not like human personality. It's very much just a set of behaviors that are very consistent over time, and that's about as far as it's going to go. You're not going to have some animal like Blue in Jurassic World that is friendly and pugnacious, but also loyal, and it's the leader of the pack, and blah, blah, blah. No. It's an animal. It behaves in a certain way, and some of them will behave that way all the time, no matter what. And you can call that personality, but it's not the same as humans.
And there is a big debate even within veterinary medicine where we think that our domestication of animals might be responsible for what we see as these distinct personalities in our dogs and our cats. But there's also a big debate as to whether or not those personalities are unique to the person that is viewing them, whether or not there is observation bias that is taking place. Like, I see very, very big personalities in my pets. But am I seeing those because I'm looking for them? Am I seeing personalities because they've adapted and taken on certain traits because they see it gets a more positive response from me? The debate rages on.
The soldier, do you know where he came from?
No.
Anyone he might have come in contact with?
No.
And the origin could have come from anywhere.
It's a shame you had to fly all the way out here to figure that out.
Yeah, so sort of my last one is going to be the sort of idea of either the rare or specific plant that's needed to cure a disease or the need for a patient zero.
Always
a plant. That I see quite often. Yeah, the plant is the one that definitely gets me. The patient zero is also one that gets me. So
yeah,
diseases are incredibly complex topics.
Yep.
There is obviously example of, we have a huge movement in both human and veterinary medicine right now to try and return to natural cures. The thing is, yes, we used to find plants and herbs that offered us certain benefits when we didn't understand how physiology worked. So finding early plants that gave us, you know, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory effects or had mild antibiotic properties, these were things that were a game changer in a day and age where we didn't understand that, you know, you were made up of millions and millions of cells all interconnected and working at different levels, right? We didn't know where the heart was. We didn't know how the GI worked. We thought that humans were made up of four different humors that had to be bled and adjusted and mixed in certain quantities.
Oh, that humors is so such nonsense. We have Galen to thank for that. That was absolutely ridiculous and resulted in a lot of very bad medicine for a very, very, even until the early like 19th century or the late 19th century.
Yeah,
you're sick, we better cut your veins open so you can bleed all those bad humors out of you.
As much as Galen did, he held science back by a lot, which is a different topic we can cover at some other date. But the main idea just being that we're now into far more complex diseases, processes, viruses, things like that, that require much more complex answers. I mean, people rage against cancer, and the fact is that cancer is just the natural processes of your own body running amok.
Yep.
It's cells that have had that replication signal that says you can only replicate this many times, and when you do, you have to be a certain type of useful cell that just go, no, we're not going to focus on that, we're just going to replicate like mad, and we're not going to do anything. And they start creating
touching on
these...
that, I think we have, at least for our audience, there's probably people that know a lot about this topic, but for those of you who don't know, cancer isn't this magical disease that can be applied to every single situation. There's so many different types of it, but at its core, all it is uncontrollable cell growth. Normally, your cells will grow and replicate, and after a time, they will die. But when cancer happens, they just keep growing and growing and growing and growing. And that's why you get tumors, because it's just a mass of tissue that keeps growing. And it can then lead to some very, very unfortunate side effects, which end up killing you more often than not.
Right. And the problem with trying to cure cancer is, how do you cure a part of the body without wiping out the rest of the body? It's the concept that's normally applied as the magic bullet, the idea of something that passes through you that takes the disease and the horrible stuff with it, but leaves the rest of you okay. There is no magic plant that we're going to find. There are agents that we find that have properties that work really well with fast replicating growing tissue and can be used in a lab setting. There is still a lot to be learned from the natural world in terms of studying plants and animals, but there's going to be no single agent that we find and apply and fixes everything. I know that people are super excited about the cannabinoid activities that are associated with cancer. Yeah. And that there is some good work to suggest that it is beneficial in certain cancer situations, that marijuana might have some benefits associated with oncological treatment. But it's not a magic bullet. All right, you can't just simply smoke your way to a cure. And it's something that we run into a lot in both human medicine, and I run into on a daily basis in my profession with people coming in and being like, I'm just going to feed my dog a whole bunch of marijuana and it's going to cure the cancer. And I'm like, no,
we've already had that PSA. Don't give your dogs marijuana.
Yeah. And this also feeds into the same idea then. So this need for like the rare plant also feeds into the idea of like, oh, the rare patient. And World War Z being the best example of having lots of problems with it on a lot of different levels.
Yep.
But one of the biggest is this obsession that they have that the movie starts with enlisting Brad Pitt because they need to go find patient zero. They need to find, you know, the first one that was affected to better understand the disease. That's not how diseases work.
No.
That's not how anything works. In fact, you want to study the strain that is most actively affecting people currently. You don't need to know really. I mean, finding out how it's mutated is helpful, but getting access to a patient zero might allow you to get better predictions of how it's mutated and better devise certain types of treatments or things like that. But at a core level, if it's a virus, which it is a lot of the time, you're just going to have to study the virus and figure out how to come up with a vaccine is going to be your best way to gain immunity.
It's why you get a flu shot every year, because these viruses, or they, at least for bacteria that give you colds and things like that, they have properties that allow them to change very, very rapidly, and they evolve very quickly, which is why you have to get a flu shot every single year. On the very extreme end of this example, it does not matter if you could find the first person to ever have a flu, because that flu is a million times different than what you have now. It does fuck all for you to find patient zero in that regard.
Yeah, exactly. And the flu vaccine, everybody brings this up, it's not exactly the most effective thing in the world, but it does usually give us some degree of protection against some of the most common strains. So yes, it's not perfect, it's not going to stop the flu, but it might help lower the time that you deal with the flu, and it might help protect you against certain strains.
Come on, we've got to get out of here. Now, right now. Go, let's go. Hey. Start the engine.
Yeah, just a real quick one before we wrap up here. It's kind of simple, and it's something really crazy. We see this once again in Jurassic Park, but any kind of predator or monster that roars before it attacks its prey.
Such a dumb idea.
It can be effective in a movie, I get it, especially when you're trying to engineer some kind of jump scare, where you have a very quiet, tense moment. Maybe the character or maybe even the audience doesn't notice that this creature is there, and then it roars really loud, really loudly. It's an adverb. And it really scares people. But in nature, that is so counterintuitive that it would just ruin this predator's chance at finding a meal. And one thing that people might not realize is most predators are not that effective. I think the most effective group of the most effective groups of predators are the orcas, the killer whales. And even they are only successful on half of their hunts. So half the time, they're getting nothing. And these are some of the best hunters on the planet. So right. If you're just going to go ahead and let your prey know that you're there, you're never going to catch anything. You're going to starve to death. It's going to be horrible. And you fucked.
And this is a basic idea that we seem to see. Everybody gets mad whenever the villain explains their plot to the hero, or when the hero gives the bad guy, you know, extra time, and you're sitting there and you're like, yep. Why don't you just kill him already? Like, why are you like giving him the ability to defend himself? Why didn't you just walk up and shoot him, or da 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 da? The same idea applies within ecology, right? You don't want to give warning to the thing that you're about to do in. It's not an effective strategy.
It is a waste of time and effort. But what is not a waste of time would be kind of us wrapping up here towards the end of the episode. If you want to follow Sam and I on Twitter, I'm at Hessek Adam, all one word. Sam is at Sam Perrin, NTNU. Give him a tweet, let him know, ask him how that uprising in Greece is going, wish him the best. You can follow the podcast at C_Animalia. If you want to check out our website, cinematicaanimalia.com, see some of our cool work. And if you want to see some more of the, maybe the more science-y, hardline ecology stuff that Sam and I like to do at our website, check out ecologyforthemasses.com. We do paper breakdowns, interviews with prominent scientists, opinion pieces on really cool things going on in the world of ecology research. And if you want to send us an email, ask us questions, give us comments or concerns, hit us up at cinematica.animalia@gmail.com. And just remember, the monsters aren't real, but the science is.